This podcast is presented by Convergence, a magazine for radical insights.
You know, this were like breeding grounds for isolation sometimes. And so I think that the antidote to authoritarianism is connection. And I believe at the core, organizing is about connecting people, about collective thought that then leads to collective action.
Welcome to the Anti-Authoritarian Podcast, a project of the 22nd Century Initiative. I'm Scott Nakagawa, one of your hosts.
Hello, friends. I'm co-host Sue Hyde. Scott and I first joined forces about 30 years ago to help defeat anti-LGBTQ ballot measures proposed by Christian authoritarian groups.
It was as true then as it is now that those of us who believe in democracy make up a supermajority of people in this country. The challenge is, how do we go from being the majority to acting like the majority?
We dig into strategy questions like these and prescriptions for change. We talk with expert guests and commentators whose scholarship, political activism, and organizing define the cutting edge of anti-authoritarian resistance. Thank you for joining us.
We know that becoming an effective countervailing force in the fight to preserve and expand upon the democratic potential of the U.S. is a heavy lift. It is one that will require us to rethink, retool, and build. All of that can feel like a big lift for community leaders already fighting to meet the basic needs of their communities. I feel that sense as well, being overwhelmed. But if we aren't part of the effort to fight back against authoritarianism, the struggle over democracy becomes a fight among elites, and whichever side wins will position itself to become the prevailing power without us. So, given all of that, and what we know from looking back at how we got here, what do we do? If a countervailing power is to rise, don't we all need to be all in?
The estimable Sulma Arias brings over 20 years of organizing experience to her role as executive director for People's Action Institute and People's Action. Sulma immigrated to Kansas from El Salvador at the age of 12 and eventually led Sunflower Community Action, where she worked on training organizers and building a base of volunteers to fight for driver's licenses and tuition access for immigrants, and fighting harmful policies during the Kris Kobach era in Kansas. Sulma worked for People's Action on national campaigns and strengthening community organizing, and also led the Fair Immigration Reform movement in the fight for immigration reform and against harmful policies coming out of the Trump administration. Sulma rejoined People's Action in 2022, and is leading the charge to build a nationwide organizing revival to rebuild and reinvigorate the field of organizing. Welcome to the Anti-Authoritarian Podcast, Sulma.
Thank you. It is great to be here. Again, I'm Sulma Arias. I am the Executive Director of People's Action. I would say that I bring to my role different journeys and identities. I'm an Indigenous woman, I'm an immigrant, I'm a woman of color, and I bring that into all of the work that I do. And I am here particularly and in this role at this moment because I happen to be a firm believer in organizing and the power that it has to transform people and meet people, as we say in organizing, meet people where they are and do our best not to leave them there.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you on, Sulma. You referenced being an immigrant. I know a little bit about you, and so I know that you are like many immigrants in the United States in that you came here to escape a repressive regime, in your case from El Salvador. And of course, you got here and you ended up in epic battles with authoritarians like Kansas attorney Kris Kobach on both immigration and voting rights, and similar fights with the Trump administration, another authoritarian administration, when you led the Fair Immigration Reform Movement. The current immigration policy debate in Congress is to the right of what Democrats used to consider beyond acceptable. Given that immigrants are the authoritarian movement's number one scapegoat and target, how can we reframe this debate and stop the scapegoating that is dividing what should be a multiracial, pro-majority, a pro-democracy, rather, a majority?
Yeah, well, that is the question of the moment. And I'm, you know, again, grateful to be here and with all of you to talk about that. So, yeah, I think you referenced, you know, my journey here and as an, you know, an immigrant from El Salvador to flee the country right after the U.S. intervention there that sort of, you know, drove thousands of us out of the country and which, you know, the United States intervened in the civil war there. Like many people, flew the country and made a home here in the state of Kansas since the age of 13 years old. At that time, when I came to the state of Kansas, I did grow up in the church. I grew up in the church, did a lot of my work in the church as part of that work that was happening by the evangelical church in the 80s to really bring in and pull a lot of us immigrants into that world. And so I grew up in church building. I became a mother in Kansas. And I talk about the way that I related to the world that was around me. I, you know, was in many ways, because I was part of a church system, of a small town, of a state where I'm from El Salvador, I felt many times very small and disconnected from the broader community. For me, that began to change at the moment that an organizer from People's Action knocked on my door. And I believe that just as that moment changed my life, we as organizers, funders, and advocates have that precious responsibility today, right? So all of us worry about what you just named, Scott, you know, this fascism, the demise of democracy that are knocking on our very mm-hmm. front door. And, you know, I remind a lot of people, organizers today, that we already know what to do. The answer is in all of us. And the answer, you know, it's in us and in our neighbors in coming together to find joy and in shaping the life we deserve with the person next door to us, our neighbor, whether they look like us or not. And I know that because I was that neighbor. And I know that because all the work that I've done in the state of Kansas, I could not have done by just pulling together people who look like me. We knew even when we were going up against, you know, Kris Kobach, that there was a lot behind Kris Kobach. There was money behind Kris Kobach, and there were a lot of lies, and that we couldn't go at him alone. We know even back then, we knew we had to build a multiracial coalition of people who saw what was behind the man and what their ultimate motives were. And you know, that I guess growing up in a state of Kansas where you actually don't have the electoral power you need to win, you actually, I think that I, you know, lean and orient towards building and getting to know the neighbor and actually connecting people around a shared, shared identity and also a shared self-interest to advance the kind of like, this is our home, this is our state, this is my home. I'm from El Salvador, but I've lived here most of my life. This is where I have a burial ground, and this is where I will be buried. So this is my home. And I think beginning as immigrants to see this place as our home and our shared interest in building the best community that we can for our kids is the same interest that all other Kansans have. And so when we went against an authoritarian and a fascist and, you know, a right-winger that Kris Kobach is, we knew we couldn't do it alone. And we knew that what was at stake was much more than just this man, right? It was our very own democracy and who we are as Kansans.
Last year, People's Action Institute published a great white paper called The Antidote to Authoritarianism, How an Organizing Revival Can Build a Multiracial, Pluralist Democracy and an Inclusive Economy. In the paper, you make a strong case that a revival of community and worker organizing is key to stopping authoritarianism. Why do you believe that's true?
Yeah, I think it's because of the reason that everything, when we are isolated from one another, I think it's, you know, is that darkness and that void of connection, which connection itself, I think it's light because it brings to bear or it brings to light something about that person that we didn't know. And I think a lot about that experience with Kris Kobach and precisely why the right wing used places that nobody else was paying attention to, like the backyards of our homes, in places like rural America, and places like Kansas, where, you know, these were like breeding grounds for isolation sometimes. And so I think that the antidote to authoritarianism is connection. And I believe at the core, organizing is about connecting people, about collective thought that then leads to collective action. And it's in the connecting and coming out of the isolation that we discover one another. And it's in discovering one another and in sharing our, you know, our concerns about our neighborhoods and our concerns about the future and our understanding of things that are happening to each other and each other's stories, that we also find solutions and we find creativity, inspiration, and ideas that we can move forward together. I think at the very core, that is the essence of the antidote that we need to fight authoritarianism, because authoritarianism bets on us not trusting each other and in us being isolated for it to succeed. And so I think that the antidote is organizing, because it's the opposite of that. It's about bringing people around a shared interest, together around a shared interest.
Hi there, this is Kaden, the publisher of Convergence, and the host of our weekly news magazine, Block and Build. If you're enjoying this show, I'd love to invite you to join me every Friday for a breakdown of the headlines with the kind of insight and analysis you've come to expect from Convergence magazine. I also get to go deep with movement journalists about their crucial reporting and get exclusive insights from some of the most strategic organizers fighting for the world that we deserve. If you're looking for a break from the news cycle that feels grounded and strategic, come along for the ride. You can find Block and Build wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe today. I hope this helps.
You know, we seem to be facing an attempt to, on the part of some people, to rule as a minority. And so getting together a popular majority to exercise collective power seems like the right antidote that might also teach us in the process how to be the kinds of leaders we need to be. And so just the seed of the genius of that in the work that you do is really something that I've admired for a long time. But, you know, speaking of that organizing revival, it sounds like something that everyone who is on the front lines of authoritarian attacks needs to take seriously. We obviously need more power. That's really plain. So how can the pro-democracy movement and its constituent organizations across communities and issue fronts more explicitly orient itself to build more power?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the idea of needing an organizing revival, and, you know, we are very clear that, you know, as we think about what it takes to build a strong democracy, right? And we're talking about not even going back to the, you know, the democracy before Trump. We understand that we must build a stronger democracy that finally uplifts everyone in America, right? Or everybody who has been silenced for so many generations. And that is the kind of democracy that I know I'm here for and that I'm trying to fight for, so that is the legacy and the work that I at least my children and grandchildren will live in and thrive in. And that's the reason why I do the work that I do. But I think it is on everybody's interest in this moment to, I come at it from having been transformed as an immigrant woman who crossed the border, who grew up in Kansas, who, you know, brought communities together to fight around a shared common interest for the kind of state that we wanted to build. And I did it through organizing, and I've done it, and I continue to do it through connecting people. That is my lane, and that is what I believe in. I think that what it will take, and it definitely at the time that, you know, a lot of us are looking for that connection, it definitely takes that connection and that, you know, on the ground organizing, but it also takes many other forms, right? It takes the consistent investment in what we call the evergreen of organizing, right? You know, it takes the strategies of communication and digital strategies. It takes electoral strategies, and it takes many forms of, you know, of work and even research. So the white paper was beautiful in its form because we came together as practitioners and said, this is where we're seeing where the field is depleted. And so we brought together other academics and funders to say, this is how we see this problem. How do you see it? And so I think that there's agreement on we don't have enough power, and we all can be doing our part to build what needs to be built in order for us to confront the threats that we see coming, not only the threats of fascism and authoritarianism, but the threats of climate isolation. And while in organizing, we can work on climate issues to pass the policies that we need for better, climate policies. What organizing can also do is build resilient communities that rely on themselves to do the very, the very minimum, to really understand at its core how not only to just work for pro-climate solutions, but also to build just the everyday resilience our community needs to work together around solidarity and other types of solutions that we haven't even thought about because we haven't had the right people at the table. So that's what I believe that organizing can do when we're facing a set of overlapping crises.
So, you mentioned the word strategy. So in terms of strategy, it feels like we're in the middle of a big, broad rejection of government and consolidated power in general, that people have grown very cynical of government at a time when it seems to me that it's really important for us to be trying to work with government, or at least to win power within government. So what is it going to take for us to reorient the field to really thinking about power in concrete terms, not just about democracy as a kind of utopian concept, but about the structures and the rules and the processes we need to win in order to ensure equitable democracy can continue to advance into the future?
Yeah, I mean, that is such a great question, Scott. I was just talking to someone over the weekend about, you know, we say that there might be just a lot of apathy towards anything. Like, there's no belief that anybody at the electoral, the governmental level can change anything. And I see a lot of that. As a woman who comes from a very conservative background, have been doing organizing for 22 years in sometimes what we call secular or more progressive spaces, I still talk to a lot of people. A lot of people from the church, or even some of my family who voted Republican in 2016, who even in my own family have like very different ideas than or understanding about what government can do for them or does for them. So I think that we're in a moment where it's important to like break. We in the progressive movement are never going to have the amounts of billions of dollars that the Republican, or the MAGA billionaires are spending to misinform and twist truths across you know, the people and everybody, even my family that's watching TikTok, and that's how they get their news, right? But I do think that it's important for us to be intentional about being on the ground, connecting to people, and don't, I think we sometimes take for granted that it's not just apathy, it's actually that people need to have conversations and have make meaning with people differently. And I think what happens is that a lot of us, especially like in the last, you know, 5-6 years, a lot of us in the progressive movement, even organizers, are not able to engage in conversations with people who don't believe like us, right? Who immediately, like, you know, I'm going to share a very quick story. I was with my husband over the weekend celebrating our anniversary. We're sitting next to a couple that my husband knows, and my husband goes to say hi. Actually, it's four people, and the person immediately says, "Oh, I know you. You are such and such person, and you are a Democrat, and I'm a conservative. So we don't have any more." That is the first thing that he says, right? And so we have gotten so used to like describing ourselves by our political parties or ideologies that we actually on both sides aren't even relating to just say, hi, we were there listening to the same concert, right? And so that we had that in common, at least we liked that. But we sort of come from very polarized conversations and way of looking at the world that we're actually not seeing each other. We're seeing past each other. We are talking past each other. So I think that one incredible opportunity that we have both across the board at this moment for both progressives, conservatives, Republicans who want to do better, and Democrats is just to reach to each other as human beings and actually connect and have conversations. We may walk out of those conversations. Maybe nothing changed in the moment, but we will walk out with a different perspective about the other person. So I think if we want to build power, we in organizing believe that we do that by bringing a number of people, bringing people together to think together and to act together. And so if we want to do that, we got to be talking to everybody, not just people who are in the same realm of thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just love that organizers have such faith in people.
Yeah, we got to. And I think it's just, to me, I tell young, especially young organizers this, Scott, that if we wake up as organizers every moment, if you don't wake up with that curiosity, and it's interesting because I before coming to organizing 22 years ago, I did a lot of work in the church building. And to me, it's like you gotta have the love for people. And even when you find, you know, you may be knocking on doors, you may have people like completely say things that, you know, sometimes it is discouraging, right? When you're knocking on the door and people say, "Oh, I don't want to talk to you because I already know you're a progressive and I'm a conservative, so we have nothing to talk about." And if you stop there and if you don't go deeper and you just walk to the next door, you could probably miss an opportunity, right, to really get deeper. And at the same time, it can be discouraging. But every day, we as organizers have to wake up with hope. Hope that if you keep knocking and if you keep going deeper in the conversations, that you will get somewhere. You will be transformed and others will be transformed in the process as well.
So, Sulma, to go from really big picture to an issue that affects almost everyone in this country, I want to ask you about a recent article. You used shopping in the supermarket to illustrate the people behind the rising costs, the big corporations and the wealthy that benefited tremendously from the Trump tax cuts and who have continued to raise prices despite falling inflation. So how did that example help people make new meaning of this problem that they face every time they go to the grocery store? And how did it help people make meaning for who is actually responsible for what they see at the grocery store in terms of prices?
Oh my God. Yeah. You know, I wrote that article thinking about some of the same thing that I hear, you know, from friends, from family, again, people that I talk to every day. And you know, after a while, I kept hearing it, and it's, you know, it can be frustrating thinking, oh my God, this has nothing to do with, you know, with the current person in office. And like, and so this was all, also, this article was also my own reflection. And I think it's also responsibility for us as progressive to actually meet people where they are. Like I was a single mom, you know, some years ago, actually going to the grocery store with that same fear of like, you know, things are just getting expensive. I could hardly afford what I was buying. So I understand that, you know, most Americans are living paycheck to paycheck and thinking the only way they make meaning of the changing world around us is because we have to go to the grocery store every day and your $100 is buying a lot less. Like, you know, $100 is buying $65 of what it used to buy 10 years ago, right? Versus what it used to buy 10 years ago. So I do understand, you know, that things are, that is the reality that we're living. So how do you help people understand about what's happening and why that's happening? And so I think we do have a responsibility to go deeper with people. And actually, it's such a conversation starter, because in every conversation, you ask people how they're doing, you know, what hurts, they're going to say two things. They feel unsafe in our neighborhoods, and things are just getting so expensive, from the rent to food prices. So I think it's important to make meaning with people about why that's happening. And, you know, simply helping understand, like, oh, did you know that, you know, the CEO of Walmart actually made $25 million last year? And that's what he takes home, even though after COVID, they raised prices for everybody. Prices never went down. They never lost a penny. You know, instead, they made more money. And that is the reality. That is the truth that, you know, that is behind all the rising prices in our groceries. But that is also the truth behind what's happening in our healthcare. And, you know, the private industry, United Health, that is denying people's health coverage when they are making billions in earnings more than ever before, right? So at some point, you got to point to the greed of corporations that are taking advantage of any political loophole to make more money that they won't even be able to spend in their lifetime. And that is the reality of what's happening. And most people, most Americans, understand that, but they've never been told the truth about what's behind the cost. And they will get it if they know the truth, but most people don't.
This podcast is presented by the 22nd Century Initiative, a hub for strategy and action for frontline activists, national leaders, and people like you.
At 22ci.org, you can sign up for our newsletter. You can learn from our anti-authoritarian playbook, which includes resources on how to block rising authoritarianism, bridge across the multiracial majority, and build an inclusive pro-democracy movement in your community.
Let's get into some of the kind of nuts and bolts here. You referenced having to bring people together across lines of difference, you know, like Republican members of your family and whatnot. I'm totally on board around that. And I know that you're using a technique called deep canvassing in order to meet people where they're at, wherever they might be at, rather than having like a kind of litmus test for how people join organizations and movements, where we begin with, do you agree with me about the following things? And then everything else follows, right? So what is deep canvassing, and what have you discovered as you and, of course, thousands of people that you've deployed? You know, what have you learned as you've talked to people on the doors and on phones?
Yeah, so deep canvass is a methodology and a tactic that we use along with other organizing tactics. But what we've discovered in our, 4 or 5 years of building up to the 2020 election, but from 2019, 2020, and especially in 2020 after, you know, we discovered 2020, and then when we discovered that, you know, we were all like facing COVID and unable to actually get on the doors, we discovered that we could actually deploy and actually have deep conversations with people and those people who were not likely going to be with us. And I think that at that time we were looking at two issues, the issue of climate and how do we talk to people around the Green New Deal and like how do we actually connect. Mm-hmm. The key mm-hmm. about Deep Canvas, both on climate, and at that time we were using climate and immigration as two of the issues where we know that were polarizing issues where people may not have been on the same page with us. But the beauty of Deep Canvas is that both the person is walking in with a train, you know, you're being trained on how to talk to people, but it's also not just the training and the tactic and the methodology itself. It's actually having, as a human being, the disposition to actually be in a space with somebody, you know, either in the space face-to-face or on the phone, with someone who you know it doesn't agree with you and you're not walking away. You're actually trained, like, what are the questions that I need to ask in order to find connection with this person? And this woman, Ebony, down home, North Carolina, who talks about it so beautifully and has done, the team there has done such an incredible job of reaching people across the spectrum, race and issue and place, right, in a lot of rural spaces, is that there is a curiosity that you expect to go into the conversation to change. You are supposed to learn something. So it's almost taking your hat off that, like, I know everything I want to know about this issue, and I'm going to convince this person to think like me, right? Every conversation, it's about opening up the curiosity and through, you know, questions that you're trained to ask. And it's more of a training, it's more of a discipline. Like, you listen and you ask questions and you listen, right? But the beauty and the transformation that happens in that moment is that because you're asking questions to try to find the connection, is that 9 times out of 10, in you asking those questions, you find the connection. Once you find the connection, you actually say, oh, I have that too. So, you know, my, you know, cousin or so-and-so, you know, had the same experience, and this is the connection. So it's really a beautiful conversation that is non-transactional, right? It's transformational, and that's the beauty of Deep Canvas being done very explicitly, knowing that you're going to be talking to people that on any issue may not think like you.
Sulma, the mission of the 22nd Century Initiative is to identify and strengthen a pro-democracy majority in the United States. And I know that you also, and People's Action also shares that as a goal. But I'm wondering, as you are doing your work, how are you helping people see themselves as part of a pro-democracy movement across a spectrum of issues and constituencies and organizations and other movements? Help us solve this riddle, Sulma.
I can certainly help with my part, because I think that, you know, the practice or the journey that we are in this country as we try to figure out how to govern and how to live and how to be together, it's so fascinating to me to think about, you know, where we've been, you know, as an indigenous woman from El Salvador, coming from a country like El Salvador, colonized for many years. Like, when did I in my generation see a kind of democracy that is truly representative of me, right? That I could decide and or I could see. And I think, or in this country, right, with everything, like, you know, slavery and, you know, the genocide of indigenous people in this country and everything that has gotten us here. And the fact that we're talking about democracy within enforcing a constitution that really, from the time it was written, wasn't meant for people who looked like me, right? There were no people who looked like me in that room by gender or race, right? And so to try to imagine something different in this moment to me is not only exciting, but it's the task of organizers and people who still believe that in this country we can have like a more perfect union, and that more perfect union, you know, takes all of us. So it's like, you know, if I was in El Salvador, I am trying to build a stronger country with Salvadorians, right? But here in this United States, the diversity and the number of people that we are trying to bring together to form a multiracial democracy that mirrors something none of us have ever really known is incredible to me. And it's a beautiful and it's also a very challenging task, right? So the way that we go about it here at People's Action is that we talk about governing, right? And that that is not it's not only the destination, right? It's what we're doing now. We are learning in our institutions. We are learning in our neighborhood what it means to have everybody at the table, to imagine things together, how we want to be governed, how we want to govern, and how are we inclusive to make sure that the ideas are truly involving those directly impacted, communities of color who've never been represented before, but also that don't leave anybody out, right? So if in the past, the people who were governing intentionally left people who looked like me and Black people and Indigenous people out of the governance, ideas for governing and building a strong democracy, that when we are in power and when it's our turn to govern, we don't do the same. We actually, the multiracial democracy that we want to build is inclusive and is stronger for being inclusive. And that is, you know, that is the task that we had ahead of us. And not only are we working towards building it so that in 10 or 20, or that it'll be real when we're able to get all of our people in positions of power, especially in Congress and in governance, it's actually alive now. And we practice it every day through our organizing when we decide that we want a stop sign in the corner because there's been too many accidents there. And in that neighborhood, we want to bring people together and say, well, where do we get the money to put up the sign? That in itself is a beautiful practice of democracy and governance. And to me, that's what's exciting about organizing, because it's not like we're just working for that, like, you know, decades, 500 years or 300 years from now, we're actually practicing strong democracy every day when we organize and we are intentional about being inclusive of all the voices that are impacted by those decisions. And that to me is exciting.
Exciting to me too. Especially at the scale that you're doing it, it's really quite a remarkable thing, I think. It gives me a lot of hope. All right. Soma, in many states, your affiliated organizations are building governing power at the local level. So tell us more about what governing power means in the context between authoritarian forces and multiracial majorities and what you're doing about it.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, organizing is at the core of what we do. Our vision for what we call a long-term agenda, and especially as we are looking at the next 10 years and how do we reverse a lot of the damage from this, you know, authoritarian forces in states where we've seen the majority of state trifectas go over the last decade or two from blue trifectas to red, right? So our goal and part of the work that we're doing over the, not just this electoral cycle, right? We know that we know that we are a long ways from getting what we want and what we need for our communities to truly be in a place to govern. But what we're doing is we're looking at a 10-year span of time, and we're looking at, so what are the states in which we need a layered approach to the organizing and base building that is the evergreen? What are the pipelines of people who we want to co-govern with? That means that we're looking at races, down-ballot races in every state and at every level of governance, so that we can actually build the pipelines of people who we want to look like us, who we want to represent us, right? And who also want to co-govern with us. So we're looking at the next 10 years and how will we move, not only build organization, but also build the kind of co-governance infrastructure by electing leaders into positions at every level, from school board to city council to mayor in different cities, because we've realized that those positions matter. And it matters in cities that are trying to define, you know, school budgets or the investments in local communities. So up and down the ballot, we're looking at states over the next 10 years where we want to build governing trifectas with people who look like us, and we want to train leaders who run for elections. And it's what we've been doing. I think in 2022, we endorsed over 200 candidates at the local and city state level that actually came, some of them came through our pipeline for candidate pipeline when we train candidates to run for positions across the board. And for us, this is, you know, this is part of the joy in the work, that people who come to our training, whether that be organizers training, and fall in love with the vision of a governance structure where, like, yes, we want to be in governance with people who look like us and who actually are accountable to the people who put them in office. That is a long-term trajectory for us. And everything that we do with our, you know, electoral and governance models that we implement in the field are part of building that, not just at the federal level, but also at the state level, with a 10-year plan to turn 32 states. So that for us is 10 more states where we can build the blue trifectas.
Yeah. So Sulma, your 10-year plan, your big vision for co-governance and people-powered democracy is beautiful, and some of our listeners want to take action. So, how can I get involved in people's action?
Oh, I love that question, because we actually have we've been working to build the infrastructure, right? So that's not so internal. While we need to do a lot of work internal, we've actually over the last 6 months have built enough infrastructure to actually begin to bring people in, right? So now there's at least three ways people can go to our website and join a deep canvas training orientation, where they can learn everything about how they can begin to transform their lives and the lives of others, but being in community with other people and learning how to deep canvas and become part of that. There's also two other training opportunities through our training modules that people can do online. The basics of organizing, which is, you know, also monthly, open to everybody. Go to the website. Find opportunities. There's at least three opportunities that you can take month to month if you want to learn basic skills of organizing to transform your neighborhoods, your communities, and actually transform yourselves. Like in this, I think we're in a world of, like, everybody's out looking to buy, you know, what are the best greens that are going to help us be healthy or exercise. Actually being in connection to people is a number one thing that we can do to be healthy. And in organizing, you know, who would have thought, like, yes, you can actually build very simple tools that help you be in deep connections with people. Deep Canvas is one of them.
All right. Well, Sulma, this has been really inspiring. I just love that you are just so committed to people power. And I love that you escaped a repressive regime abroad, came to the United States, and saw these authoritarians pop up and decided, I'm not running, and are putting up a fight that I think we can all learn from. So thank you for all of that and for joining us here.
Thank you, Scott and Sue.
Hey, thanks again for listening. Find more episodes of the Anti-Authoritarian Podcast on all of your favorite platforms, and also at 22ci.org and convergencemag.org. Direct links to these and other resources referenced in this episode are in the show notes.
The Anti-Authoritarian Podcast is created by the 22nd Century Initiative and published by Convergence Magazine. Our theme music is After the Revolution by Carsey Blanton and is licensed under Creative Commons. The show is hosted by Scott Nakagawa and Sue Hyde. Executive producers are James Mum and Tony Esperge. Our producer is Josh Elstro, and Yong Chan Miller is our production assistant.